Mr. Hayward, Reel 23. We've now got, you've got to Guildford, and this was a demobilisation centre. How about exactly did they demobilise you?
I think we had to take it in stages, going from room to room, picking up civilian kit as we went and handing in certain items of our own kit. We were allowed to retain one battle dress suit and our army belt, I certainly kept my original 5¼ cap badge, and probably the beret. Yes, I certainly did keep the beret, because if we didn't particularly want to wear our civilian clothes straight away, and I have an idea that I went home in uniform, so we would obviously have to look like a soldier going home, so we'd still have one pair of boots, battle dress, probably a certain amount of army underwear, socks, and this webbing belt. So, but certainly, I was trying to think whether we kept our greatcoats. I don't think we did somehow, because having brass buttons on, they wouldn't be very much good to us in civilian life. So, at that time of the year, we'd probably, if it was chilly or wet, we'd probably make use of the civilian raincoat they issued us with. So we did get a suit. You did have a choice of about three different kinds of suit. I had to choose, I remember it was a striped blue suit.
Was it any good? Because the quality, I mean.
The quality was reasonable. It didn't last any longer than, say, the normal sort of suit you'd wear in civilian life. Adequate, probably lasted about 3 years with office life before it began to look a bit tired. I can't remember whether we were issued with things like shirts or ties. That doesn't click at all. But I suppose we must have had some kind of an issue of a shirt. Well, maybe not. After all, a suit and a raincoat. Oh, we did have a hat. I remember having a Trilby hat at the time. Don't remember getting things like a pair of shoes. I think it was fairly basic what we got. And it was all put into a cardboard box which we tucked under our arm, and then caught the train. And I had a sort of a written up railway ticket, which was part of our demob book. It was torn out of the demob book and it had been filled in advance, that I chose to route myself home via Reading from Guildford. My parents were living in between the Slough and Maidenhead. So by going to Reading from Guildford, which you could get through the train, that meant I could come back to the nearest station was Burnham Bucks, between Maidenhead and Slough. So I'd get the train at Reading back to Burnham and then walk home from there, because my parents wouldn't know when to expect me. They'd have an inkling that I was coming home, but wouldn't know exactly when.
Now, what about your wife?
Yes, my wife. She'd come at my parents' suggestion, in order to sort of acclimatise her to English life before I got back, they suggested she come over ahead of me. So she came over with a big trunk of her possessions on the 26th of August. So in effect she was coming over about a month before me.
Now, what about returning to... How did she settle in? Sorry, I wanted to ask about that first.
Oh, she settled in very well. My mother really put herself out, because mother at that time would be about, 46, so she'd be about 55 at the time. And she put herself out to show her the routine of the coinage and shopping, and rail from one end of the county. And that wouldn't be too easy because the farmhouse where my parents lived at the time, it wasn't on a bus route. To get to the bus route, you had to walk nearly a mile. And by the time you got there, well, you were there where the local shops were. Mother tended to shop at the Cooperative Society, which was opposite the end of the road, and had virtually everything there for basic needs. So that would be where my wife would get used to shopping. And eventually...
Did she seem happy when you got back?
Oh, yes. Yes, she did indeed. There was just a spot of bother with my two elder sisters who were still at home. Sorry, one elder sister and a younger sister who were still at home. They were working locally in the Slough area. And they came home and they tended to... not exactly treat my wife as if she was a servant, but they tended to treat her as if she should be doing things for them as well as for my parents. So,
but no real problems?
No real major problems. Well, obviously after a year at home, we began to get itchy feet. We wanted to be able to set up on our own.
Now, I wanted to ask about getting back into employment. You'd been an insurance clerk, essentially, before. I mean, did you go straight back to your old job? Or?
Yes, I had to in the end.
Did you not want to? I mean, how did you feel about the whole question of it?
Well, during my time in the army, the closing stages, when I was in Germany waiting for DMOB, this was in April 1946. I got here that I had an interview with the Education Board. They'd gone round asking anybody if they wanted to become teachers. And I got interested in this. But that fizzled out because they asked me some questions about Shakespeare, which I couldn't answer properly. I think I'd only studied one of Shakespeare's plays at school, Macbeth. And they must have chosen some other question me on, and that apparently caused my teaching career to be finished. That was snuffed out very quickly. And when I got home, I still was a little bit unhappy about the idea, possibly because of this office job in the army. A little bit unhappy about the idea of going back to my old job in an office after all these exciting years in the army. It didn't really appeal to me very much. And so I started making inquiries through the local services. About getting a job as a civil engineer, and the idea I had at the time was becoming a quantity surveyor. The thought of ordering materials and calculating the right quantities for a job interested me, and I thought, well, it's basically an outside job too. So I inquired about this, and apparently at that time the government would make you a grant. But to a married person like me, it wouldn't have been sufficient to support us because the course was full time. So that meant I couldn't work and study as a lot of people did later. They studied at night and worked during the day. I couldn't do that, so I had to abandon that idea, and there was nothing for it but to go back to my old job.
Had they'd held it open for you?
They'd held it open, so I went back to travelling up to London to this firm called the Century Insurance Company.
How did you settle back? I mean, did it take you long to settle in?
No, they all made me very welcome. I recognised some faces, and some of them had been in the services like myself. Some had got out sooner, some were to arrive back later. But basically, there was no problem with settling in again. It was just the job itself. And the idea of working in London. And what happened eventually was that my wife began to put the pressure on to set up home anywhere but living with my parents for a day. And I saw the light, got the message, and asked my firm whether I could get a transfer with the same firm away from London into an area where there wasn't such an acute housing shortage, because after all Slough was near London, and at that time they were rehousing a lot of Londoners in new housing estates built outside Slough, which weren't for the locals. So we would be well down on any housing list we were put against. So in the end, the company refused to transfer me. They said, "Hey, you haven't been trained enough. You haven't got the knowledge to go to a branch." So in desperation, I walked into an insurance company's office in Slough, which happened to be the Britannic, but now part of the Commercial Building Group, I think. And they said, they took note of what I wanted, and they obviously played ball. They'd sent it off to their head office people, which turned out to be the company called the Ocean Excellent Guarantee Corporation in Moorgate in London. So I went up there for interview, and they said, "Do you think you could handle this job in Leeds, at their branch in Leeds?" Which was sort of understudying the chief clerk. And so I flannelled a bit and said I'd got lots of experience in accident work, and this is what they wanted. But I hadn't had any experience in branch life, and so I flannelled a bit and said that anything I didn't know I would easily pick up. And so it turned out I went into this office in City Square, Leeds, and I soon acquired the necessary knowledge to take over from the chief clerk. I mean, you have to be away. But
and that was it then. You settled down.
I settled down into this branch life atmosphere of and I found that quite interesting, because you were under a bit of pressure. There was pressure there even in those days, and so you know I had to get on with it, and of course that kept me busy, which is what I wanted.
Now, the only other thing I want to look at is the question of your continuing links with the Fife and Forth RE Yeomanry. Because, I mean, did you join the Regimental Association afterwards? Because you were the point I'm particularly interested in is why you decided to form the South of the Border Group, which you did about 2 years ago, 96, 95?
It was we were sending out the first letter in December 1995,
so
and it got going early in 96.
Now, why did you decide to do that? You'd been a member of the ordinary Regimental Association, I presume, had you, or not?
No, I hadn't. I didn't even know one existed. Due to the fact that we were bringing up a family, and we'd settled in Bradford at the time, working in Leeds, but settled down in Bradford. That was because my aunt had secured a rented terraced house for us there in Bradford, so that solved their housing problems. The attitude of most of the troops when they were anxiously waiting for demobilisation was like myself. I wasn't quite like, you know, there were ones that said, "When I get out of the army, I won't even join two pieces of string together." And that was the expression that sticks in my mind of those days. I didn't feel that I didn't want to join anything. I did join all sorts of things during my return to civilian life. I retained my membership of the Youth Hostels Association, for instance. And eventually began to take an interest in the church again, anything that was going on there. But to answer your question about the Scottish side, during the regimental days, I found them that because the regiment tended to exude a sort of family atmosphere to the ones that were in it right from the start, I never really felt that I would want to rejoin an association connected with a group that was like a family. And of course, after the war, there would be a lot of them surviving of that type. So, but basically, I didn't even know there was a Scottish association. Nobody had approached me to join one. I gather this happened in the Australians. They did approach people to keep in touch with them. And the question was probably asked told me then that I probably wasn't really interested. I think it largely depended on where the association met. And of course, in the fight and forth case, it was in Scotland, mainly Dundee. And there was no way I could afford to travel up in those days to meetings, because eventually things got so bad just after the war that I was forced to go to my job in Leeds on my bicycle. I couldn't even afford the fares. And that caused me eventually to get a job in Bradford itself.
But it's still in insurance.
Still in insurance. Yeah.
Now, so what sprang you into action in late 95 then?
What happened then was that in 1994, word got round, and it started off with me largely because I put an advert in the Legion Journal. I'd become interested then in trying to trace my old tank driver, Eric Penman, and also Lieutenant Dark. And I wanted to find out if there was an association in existence then that would supply me with this information of the addresses. So, by putting an advert in a Scottish newspaper, by putting this advert in the Legion Journal, did anybody know of Eric Penman? That was the gist of the advert. I got this reply. It took a year, by the way, for this advert to appear in the journal. It took a whole year and it suddenly popped up. I got that the reply that came was strange because it came from Holland. It came from a chap in the Legion in Holland. And he said, I see that you were in the fight and fought for Yeomanry. He said, do you know of anybody apart from yourself of the regiment, because the city of Antwerp were inviting members of the division. They were allowing 150 members of the 11th Army Division to come back for a celebration in Antwerp at their expense in September 1994. So this got me busy, and I wrote to the ones that I'd got to know about, because at a similar time I put an advert in a Scottish newspaper, and I had a reply from a chap who is now dead, who was a sergeant cook in the regiment, in the catering side. He'd sent me this book about the regiment, which, like you, I've now photocopied.
Seller's
book. He sent me that. He said, oh, this has been all around the country, but you might as well have a look. So I copied what I wanted, sent it back to him. And that got things going. So through him and through other replies I'd had, I got a few names, which I wrote to hastily, particularly Tommy Wilmot, the ex-SQMS. He got around his circle, and we eventually raised 19 people from the regiment, including myself, to go to Antwerp. Now, it was on that trip, and then later that year, the Regimental Association had a dinner, which they only have once in 3 years. So I went to that one. That was in 1995. Sorry, I said later that year, but it was the next year. So there was the two things, the Antwerp do, where I'd met some of the old chaps from the regiment, and then there was later the Scottish dinner in 1995. And it was on the train journey coming back from that dinner in 95, that was November, that those of us who were on the train talked about forming some little group where we could meet occasionally, possibly once a year. So I said to them, well, I'll start the ball rolling, I'll think of a letter, I'll write a letter to all the people I know that I found out the addresses of that's in England that can't get up to these Scottish dudes.
That was the idea then, an English group. South of the Border group.
South of the Border group, including any Scotsmen that were still around in England, but who couldn't afford or didn't want to go to the Scottish dudes because of the distance. And this idea grew. It grew from a very small beginning. We did, as I said in my original letter, we thought the best we could hope for was perhaps a dozen, but it has now grown. We've got 80, as you'll see from that list I gave you. With your printed list, you've got 78, and with the two new members I've given you, we are now up to 80.
And why is it so important to you, do you think? Because it is important to you.
Yes, it is important to get people weaving, like you're doing, with the idea of preserving their memories. And this theme has come out in the last newsletter. Ron Culture editor wrote a really smashing opening page, I thought, to try and get people to put their memories down and not to let their family throw them away if they die, to get them preserved and to think about where they're going to be preserved and who's going to get them. And so we're very, very pleased with the reaction we're getting from the members of our group. Some of them have said that they're unlikely to attend a function, but they really appreciate the newsletters. And so far, our subscription is covering the cost, and with a little bit left over. So we have a fund now which we can use if something special crops up. And the latest idea is that that's if it comes to fruition, is that we want to make a contribution through our membership to this arboretum that they're putting up in the middle of somewhere to commemorate these different regiments. So that idea has taken, it's made a start, in other words, but we haven't yet got to the stage where a note is going into the newsletter, because we're waiting for one of the chaps to sort out what he's going to do about it, to give us a note, to tell us more about the project, in other words.
Right, well, I wish you well with it. Thank you very much.